should guide society forward. They were claiming that they themselves were the experts who should do so. The period of constitution-making is past now, Woodrow Wilson huffed. We have reached a new territory in which we need new guides, the vast territory of administration. As we've seen, the progressives were not the first to advocate the creation of extra-legal administrators licensed by the general will to wield arbitrary power for the greater good. Rather, the progressive desire for a new aristocracy of expertise was yet another example of how the old reactionary drives of human nature continually reappear in new forms. As Jefferson warned, the natural progress of things is for liberty to yield and government to gain ground. My only quibble with Jefferson here is that he chose the wrong word. The dynamic he was describing was not progress, but decay or corruption. So, what happens when you commit to the notion that there's a special class of administrators allegedly insulated from politics with a providential writ to do good without reference to the law or the voters? You get the administrative state. What is the administrative state? Most directly, it is the fruit of the Second American Revolution. As we've seen, the progressives sought to inter the old Newtonian constitutional order and replace it with a new Darwinian paradigm. This new regime would be run by disinterested social scientists, or simply administrators who drew their legitimacy not from we the people, but from their superior insight and, in Woodrow Wilson's words, special knowledge. Wilson thought it bewildering that the reformers should have to consult with the wishes of the people. If you have the scientific facts on your side, why would you put the question before the voters? Wilson explained that the functions of government are in a very real sense independent of legislation and even constitutions, because they are as old as government and inherent in its very nature. The bulk and complex minuteness of our positive law, which covers almost every case that can arise in administration, obscures for us the fact that administration cannot wait upon legislation, but must be given leave or take it to proceed without specific warrant in giving effect to the characteristic life of the state. This was not Wilson's pet theory. This was a time when science and technology were conquering nature at a breakneck speed. Industry was achieving once unimaginable efficiencies in production. Engineering was a glamorous new vocation as experts in every field revolutionized business, medicine, infrastructure, and food production. Thanks to Darwin, the experts now believed they also understood how the human machine worked. So why not let the new social engineers revolutionize government the way technological engineers revolutionized industry and public works? What do the common people know about the science of society, i.e. social science? The public intellectual and journalist Walter Lippmann was among the foremost critics, for a time, of old-fashioned and outdated democracy. In ordinary circumstances, voters cannot be expected to transcend their particular, localized, and self-regarding opinions, he wrote. In their circumstances, which as private persons they cannot readily surmount, the voters are most likely to suppose that whatever seems obviously good to them must be good for the country, and good in the sight of God. The crucial problem of modern democracy, Lippmann added, arises from the fact that this assumption is false. Putting faith in the wisdom of the people was simply a colossal error. This widespread conviction was put into action by Woodrow Wilson, for whom Lippmann had worked as an advisor. While Madison believed that self-interest is sown in the nature of man, Wilson believed that the science of administration could elevate man above his nature and the people he serves. The old dream of the perfectibility of man would be achieved in, of all types, the bureaucrat. Ronald J. Pristrito adds, Wilson assumed, just as Hegel had in the philosophy of right, that a secure position in the bureaucracy, with tenure and good pay, would relieve the civil servant of his natural self-interestedness, thereby freeing him of his particularity and allowing him to focus solely on the objective good of society. It is vital to underscore once again that intellectuals draw their ideas from the times they live in. There's a feedback loop at work in every age. Just as the American founding was an expression of the American mind, as Jefferson put it, and just as rebelling against the British and romantic nationalism was fueled by a popular backlash against Napoleon and the Enlightenment among the German people, the progressives drew sustenance from a popular backlash against capitalism itself. When confronted with the seeming chaos of capitalism and democracy, the human mind retreats to its tribal programming. This doesn't mean Americans during the first three decades of the 20th century dabbed war paint on their faces and fought with spears. We all speak in the language and symbols of the time we live in. Percival Lowell, the turn-of-the-century astronomer who built the telescope that discovered Pluto, lived at a time when large-scale canal building was a sign of technological and industrial advancement. So, when he saw straight lines on the surface of Mars, he assumed they were put there by an advanced civilization. During the Progressive Era, industry, engineering, medicine, and science were making incredible breakthroughs. For entirely understandable reasons, progressive intellectuals and Americans generally assumed that if science and technology could solve age-old problems in real life, if industrial managers could create amazingly efficient new forms of organization, then surely experts could do the same thing for politics. This was a time when social science was new. The phrase social engineering had no negative connotation, and it was assumed that political science was, or could be, every bit as scientific as physics or chemistry. But enough with the theory and philosophy. What was the administrative state in practical terms? Put most simply, it was the vast enlargement of the government. But this simplification doesn't capture the revolutionary nature of the administrative state, because the new army of regulators and revenuers worked outside the constitutional framework, which is why the administrative state is sometimes called the fourth branch of government. For reasons I'll discuss in the next chapter, I think this label misses the mark. Congress is responsible for making policy, also known as legislation. The president, the head of the executive branch, is responsible for executing that policy. But with the rise of the administrative state, bureaucrats began driving the policymaking process. By the end of Wilson's first term, the administrative state had been created. Personal income was now taxed directly by the federal government, as were corporations and estates. Big industries were broken up. The newly minted Federal Reserve regulated money, credit, and banking. The Federal Trade Commission supervised domestic industry, and its new tariff commission regulated international trade. State and federal labor legislation mandated workmen's compensation, banned child labor, compelled schooling of children, established minimum wages and maximum hours, and established pensions for single mothers with young children. Armies of regulators inspected factories, intervened in businesses, and demanded all manner of licenses to work in various fields. One can certainly argue that some of these reforms were valuable and necessary, but that is a different argument. What was revolutionary was the argument that the state should take its own counsel on what society needed. Social expediency, as Frank Goodenow put it, now trumped constitutional fidelity and democratic sovereignty. All of this happened before Wilson plunged America into World War I. During the war, the American government became vastly more intrusive, not only economically, but also politically. President Wilson's war to make the world safe for democracy obviously had ample support for its expressed foreign policy aims, particularly among the hawkish Teddy Roosevelt wing of the progressive movement, who tended to think Wilson wasn't belligerent enough. But for the social engineering wing, international affairs were largely incidental. What fascinated them was what John Dewey called the social possibilities of war. Dewey meant by that phrase that he wanted the war to force Americans to give up much of our economic freedom. He continued, "We shall have to lay by our good-natured individualism and march in step." He hoped the war would constrain the individualistic tradition and convince Americans of the supremacy of public need over private possessions. Another progressive put it more succinctly, "Laissez-faire is dead, long live social control." Randolph Bourne, the dissident progressive intellectual who famously declared war is the health of the state, was almost alone in noticing the peculiar congeniality between the war and these men. He added that it is as if the war and they had been waiting for each other. During the war, all of the tribal impulses were given free rein. Woodrow Wilson demonized the others in our midst, the so-called hyphenated Americans, i.e. German Americans, Italian Americans, and any other ethnicity or group that didn't commit to what many called 100% Americanism. Any man who carries a hyphen about with him carries a dagger that he is ready to plunge into the vitals of this republic whenever he gets the chance, Wilson proclaimed. Under Wilson's administration, America created the first modern propaganda ministry in the world, the Committee for Public Information. It threw thousands in jail for criminal thoughts and speech. It enlisted the help of an army of quasi-official fascisti, the American Protection League, who beat up protesters, interrogated hyphenated Americans, and enforced loyalty to the state. Economically, the government pursued a policy that was widely dubbed war socialism. Big corporations were essentially enlisted in the war effort and cartelized. The state didn't nationalize every industry outright. Instead, it pursued a policy of neo-guildism. The point was that the economy had to be oriented towards the aims of the state in all matters. Over 5,000 mobilization agencies were created to make sure all of the oars pulled in the same direction. The state, Robert Higgs adds, virtually nationalized the ocean shipping industry. It did nationalize the railroad, telephone, domestic telegraph, and international telegraphic cable industries. It became deeply engaged in manipulating labor management relations, securities sales, agricultural production and marketing, the distribution of coal and oil, international commerce and markets for raw materials and manufactured products. Its Liberty bond drives dominated the financial capital markets. It turned the newly created Federal Reserve System into a powerful engine of monetary inflation to help satisfy the government's voracious appetite for money and credit. In the 1918 midterm elections, the Republicans took back Congress. 2 years later, the Republicans reclaimed the White House as well on a platform of a return to normalcy. The slogan resonated with Americans fed up not just with war, but also with domestic authoritarianism. The progressives who saw the war as an exemplary use of state planning were dejected that the American people had turned their backs on them. As a consequence, as I detail at length in Liberal Fascism, The Secret History of the American Left from Mussolini to the Politics of Change, the progressives cast their eyes to advanced countries that continued the struggle for social engineering and scientific management of society, fascist Italy and Soviet Russia. The American progressives' rallying cry during the Roaring Twenties was a plaintive, "We planned in war, why not in peace?" A dozen years after Wilson left office, Franklin Roosevelt entered office. The lingering depression of 1929 provided ample ammunition and popular support for finding a replacement for laissez-faire capitalism, even though government interference had contributed to the economic problems the country faced. Roosevelt picked up right where Wilson left off, transforming Wilson's wartime agencies into permanent fixtures of the state. The Securities and Exchange Commission was an extension of the Capital Issues Committee of the Federal Reserve Board. The Reconstruction Finance Corporation was an updated version of the War Finance Corporation. FDR's Public Housing Initiative was run by the architect of World War I-era housing policies. Of course, Roosevelt went much further than Wilson. With Congress's help and the American people's approval, American government was permanently transformed into a state. In the next chapter, we look at what has become of the administrative state. 9. The administrative state, the shadow government. In the early days of the Trump administration, then White House senior advisor Steve Bannon laid out his three priorities. The first was national security and sovereignty. The second, economic nationalism. The third was the deconstruction of the administrative state. For many journalists and casual political observers, this third term was a head-scratcher. But for intellectual conservatives, it was a cause for celebration. Sometimes called the regulatory state or the fourth branch of government, the administrative state is today a vast complex of bureaucrats and regulators and the rules they work by outside the constitutional order. They make rulings, often without the slightest feedback from voters or even elected officials. When rulemaking does include a public comment period, it is often more ceremonial than democratic. And the regulator's success has been so complete that elected officials have been willing accomplices in this travesty. Congress, as an institution, abdicated its sole responsibility to legislate. The courts have abandoned their obligation to safeguard the separation of powers. And presidents of both parties have proved unable or unwilling to curtail the bureaucracy. For the most part, Congress no longer makes laws the way the founders intended. They outsource the heavy lifting to the bureaucracy. This was already true when James Burnham published The Managerial Revolution, one of the first seminal works on the subject, in 1941. Laws today in the United States, in fact most laws, are not being made any longer by Congress, Burnham wrote, but by the NLRB, SEC, ICC, AAA, TVA, FTC, FCC, the Office of Production Management, what a revealing title, and the other leading executive agencies. How well lawyers know this to be the case. Consider the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. Journalist Philip Klein dived into the fine print and found that there are more than 2,500 references to the Secretary of Health and Human Services in the healthcare law. In most cases, she's simply mentioned as the Secretary. A further breakdown finds that there are more than 700 instances in which the Secretary is instructed that she shall do something, and more than 200 cases in which she may take some form of regulatory action if she chooses. On 139 occasions, the law mentions decisions that the secretary determines. At times, the frequency of these mentions reaches comic heights. For instance, one section of the law reads, "Each person to whom the secretary provided information under subsection D shall report to the secretary in such manner as the secretary determines appropriate." It is impossible to quantify the discretion, i.e. arbitrary power, Congress bestowed on the HHS secretary. Either the new powers and responsibilities given to the secretary are too complicated for even HHS to figure out, Klein writes, or they're so arbitrary that then HHS Secretary Kathleen Sebelius can pick and choose how she'll comply with parts of the law. But this merely scratches the surface of the administrative state. Whole agencies are independent of political control, which is very different from saying they are independent from politics. Consider just one example. According to the Constitution, only Congress can levy a tax. This is not some mere procedural nicety. It is a concrete expression of the founders' core conviction that taxation must be legitimized by representation. That, after all, was the crux of their argument with King George. And that is why Article 1 of the Constitution requires that all bills for raising revenue shall originate in the House of Representatives, a.k.a. the People's Chamber. But Congress has grown comfortable relinquishing this power. In 1996, the Federal Communications Commission was granted the authority to raise taxes as it sees fit. The Universal Service Fund started as a tax on long-distance phone calls. Originally set at 3%, within a decade, the fee reached 11%, all absent congressional approval. During the Obama administration, the FCC moved toward imposing a similar tax on broadband internet services, in part because revenue had fallen off due to people abandoning landlines. The revenues ostensibly go to pay for expanding access to the internet in rural areas and providing computers for poor schools and libraries. But there have also been numerous scandals in which the monies were poorly spent, misallocated, and sluiced to politically connected players. As we'll see, this should be expected. In 2002, under the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board was given the power to fund itself with taxes on publicly traded companies as it sees fit. The board sets its budget for the year, writes economist Christopher DeMuth, divides that amount by the number of U.S. companies weighted by their market capitalizations, and sends each company a bill. In 2004, the budget was $103 million. In 2005, the Accounting Oversight Board unilaterally increased its budget by 33% to $137 million. Since then, the budget has nearly doubled to $268 million as of 2017. In fairness, the Securities and Exchange Commission must approve the board's budgets, but a close reading of the Constitution reveals that the SEC is not a nickname for Congress. The power of the purse is the essence of Congress's power and authority, and its members voluntarily abdicated it. The term fourth branch of government is far too pallid a descriptor for what more properly should be called a shadow government, a state within the state, or imperium in imperio. There's nothing intrinsically sinister in the idea of a fourth branch of government. The founders could have divided the federal government's power four ways instead of three if they had wanted to. So long as the doctrine of separated powers was maintained, who cares? The administrative state is no fourth branch of government. It is a parallel government, operating in the shadows outside the light of democratic transparency. The best indicator of this stems from the fact that members of the administrative state are not subject to the same system of justice as the rest of us. Charles Murray describes this system well. If you are prosecuted for violating a regulation issued by the EPA, OSHA, HHS, Department of Energy, or any of the myriad other federal regulatory agencies, you appear before an administrative law judge, ALJ, sitting in an administrative law courtroom. An ALJ is selected by the agency whose cases he will hear and is subsequently an employee of that agency. The agency gets to choose its preferred candidate from among the three top-rated candidates identified by the Office of Personnel Management. An administrative law judge is exempt from performance reviews and other oversight by the regulatory agency, but may be overruled by the head of the agency. There's no jury. When appearing in an administrative court, You do not get a lawyer unless you pay for it. Most rules of evidence used in normal courts do not apply. The legal burden of proof placed on the lawyer making the case for the regulatory agency is a preponderance of the evidence, not clear and convincing evidence, let alone evidence beyond a reasonable doubt that you are guilty. If the administrative judge thinks that it's a 51-49% call in favor of the regulatory agency that accused you, you're found guilty. If the administrative court judge's decision is adverse, you may, in most cases, appeal that decision to another body within the agency. Although it is necessary to explain the administrative state, my deeper aim here is to explain how this sorry state of affairs is an example of the corruption of the Founders Project. The Constitution is indisputably clear. At the federal level, only Congress can legislate. The executive branch executes the law, hence the word executive. As John Adams said, the president enjoys the whole executive power after divesting it of those badges of domination called prerogatives. Defenders of the administrative state today use the same arguments the progressives used. Such unaccountable power is simply the very definition of good modern governance. The truth, however, is that it is a throwback to pre-modern forms of state power. The best authority on this subject is the prominent legal historian Philip Hamburger, a professor at Columbia University. In his seminal book, Is Administrative Law Unlawful?, Hamburger demonstrates that the rise of the administrative state is a reactionary effort to restore the lawlessness of arbitrary power banished by the founders. Hamburger uses the term absolute power, much the way I've been using concentrated power or arbitrary power. For our purposes, it is a distinction without a difference in that we both mean the wielding of power without lawful checks or popular consent. I prefer arbitrary power because it is more suggestive of the human whim behind it. But Hamburger is arguing in the context of a legal tradition that associated the term absolute power with prerogative power of kings. Hamburger offers three reasons why administrative law is unconstitutional. First, like the old absolute power, administrative power runs outside the law because it is not directly answerable to or derived from constitutional, legislative, or judicial authority. Second, administrative law is not only extra-legal, but supra-legal. Supra-legal is a fancy way of saying above the law. The administrative state is precisely that because judges defer to its authority. In feudal monarchies, the king or queen's rule is above the common law, in effect creating two systems of justice, one for the people and another for the state. That is the arrangement we have under the administrative state. And third, the administrative regime consolidates in one branch of government the powers that the Constitution allocates to different branches. This blatantly violates the Madisonian architecture of our republic. As Madison says in Federalist No. 47, the accumulation of all powers, legislative, executive, and judiciary, in the same hands, may justly be pronounced the very definition of tyranny. Clarence Thomas, one of the few Supreme Court justices to see this abomination for what it is, has chastised the courts for having overseen and sanctioned the growth of an administrative system that concentrates the power to make laws and the power to enforce them in the hands of a vast and unaccountable administrative apparatus that finds no comfortable home in our constitutional structure. The legal origins of the administrative state in America are somewhat disputed by legal scholars, though the conventional explanation is that it began with the Interstate Commerce Commission in 1887 and then was massively expanded first under Wilson and later under the New Deal and Great Society. But that misses the point. The history of administrative law, Hamburger writes, reaches back many centuries. Indeed, this sort of power, which is said to be uniquely modern, is really just the most recent manifestation of a recurring problem. It thus is not a coincidence that the administrative law looks remarkably similar to the sort of governance that thrived long ago in medieval and early modern England under the name of prerogative. In fact, the executive's administrative power revives many details of king's old prerogative power. Administrative law thus turns out to be not a uniquely modern response to modern circumstances, but the most recent expression of an old and worrisome development. Although the label administrative is more comforting than the old term prerogative, the danger is no less acute. In the Anglo-American tradition, government officials are supposed to be subject to the same laws as everyone else, but not under the administrative state, which insulates the bureaucrats from the rule of law. If a corporation were found responsible for poisoning a river, not only would the corporation be subject to civil and criminal penalties, but so would, at least in certain cases, the corporate officials responsible. Not so when the EPA did exactly that in 2015, when it accidentally dumped 1 million tons of toxic waste into the Animas River in Colorado. One argument that is often made in defense of the permanent bureaucracy in Washington is that it is virtually representative in some way. One version of this argument says that because the president is elected, his appointments have democratic legitimacy. And it is true that presidents typically appoint some 4,000 agency heads, commissioners, and the like. That alone should give one pause. We do not have a parliamentary system, and appointing thousands of commissars is a sorry substitute for one. The president, as Hamburger notes, is not a representative body like Congress or the British Parliament. He is an executive charged with executing laws, not making them. More to the point, the vast majority of the people who make law through administrative rulings are not picked by a president or any other elected official. Far from being elected by the people, let alone elected politicians, they are appointed by other administrators, Hamburger writes. Their authority, thus, is not even virtually representative, but is merely that of a self-perpetuating bureaucratic class. Accordingly, the suggestion that their lawmaking comes with virtual representation is illusory. Indeed, the idea that the state is an entity unto itself, charged with advancing the wheel of progress, isn't merely undemocratic. It's a form of mysticism. Hamburger comes from a different direction, but as the previous passage suggests, he comes to a familiar place for the listener who has been paying attention. The regulatory state represents the elevation of a new class, an aristocracy, of men and women who are above the law. This was the original intent of the progressives who set up the administrative state. Without checks on the power of the shadow government has, predictably, grown in power, scope, and size. It shouldn't be necessary to document what must be apparent to the average citizen. Still, in 1960, the Code of Federal Regulations had 22,877 pages. It held relatively steady until 1963, the eve of the Great Society. Then, through the end of Lyndon Johnson's term, the code increased by an average of 5,537 pages per year. In 2012, there were 174,545 pages. I could go on describing the Byzantine bureaucracies within bureaucracies within bureaucracies that spiderweb across the nation. But again, no one disputes the growth and the size of the bureaucracy because it's indisputable. The point here is to see it for what it is, shorn of modern labels. It is a class, an aristocracy, a virtual tribe that protects its parasitic interests. Parasitic is a loaded word, of course, but an appropriate one. One can even stipulate that the permanent bureaucracy does many good things. Our bodies are full of beneficial parasites we literally could not live without. But that doesn't change the fact that the parasites pursue their ends not out of altruism, but out of self-interest. One can also concede that various civil service reforms in the 19th and 20th centuries addressed some of the very real problems with graft in American government by awarding government jobs based on merit instead of political contacts. But by doing so, they basically enshrined a kind of Gnostic moat around government. The bureaucracy behaved like a guild, rigging not just the rules for entry, but for, in effect, lifetime tenure in their favor. As Hamburger puts it, civil service reform ensured that only the right sort of persons would be allowed into government, and it simultaneously secured them against being removed by those who were politically accountable to the people. The progressives' ambitions were much greater than simply sweeping the broom of reform. And by protecting the civil service from the meddling of corrupt politicians, in theory, progressives also protected them from honest and responsive politicians who want to make the government accountable. Moreover, it is simply a fantasy that the administrative priesthood can be walled off from the seductions of human nature. The Turks and Chinese castrated their civil servants and still couldn't accomplish that. By comparison, a generous salary and a nice pension seem wholly inadequate to the task. No doubt, vast numbers of bureaucrats are decent and committed professionals. But the long history of humanity teaches us that any group of people walled off from accountability can become corrupted. The scandals at the Department of Veterans Affairs are sufficient proof of that. You can falsify records and kill patients through bureaucratic subterfuge without getting fired. But if you call attention to such atrocities, that will get you terminated. Carolyn Lerner of the U.S. Office of Special Counsel explained, "Our concern is really about the pattern that we're seeing, where whistleblowers who disclose wrongdoing are facing trumped-up punishment, but the employees who put veterans' health at risk are going unpunished." Whether it was the goal or just the unintended consequence of progressives' actions, the result has been to create a new class of social engineers. The permanent bureaucracy is in reality a kind of permanent legislative, executive, and judicial branch, immune from the priorities of the people it allegedly serves. As John Locke noted, where the legislative is in one lasting assembly, always in being, there is always the threat that they will think themselves to have a distinct interest from the rest of the community. While Locke acknowledged that the class interests of permanent legislatures could lead them to seek to increase their own riches and power, his chief concern was that they would come to place their own interests and priorities over those of the people. This is no small concern. Government officials are the only citizens, and they are citizens, not feudal lords, who are allowed by law to use violence for reasons other than self-defense. In this, a flunky from the IRS or the EPA is vastly more powerful than the Koch brothers. Friedrich Hayek observed, "The power which a multiple millionaire, who may be my neighbor and perhaps my employer, has over me is very much less than that which the smallest functionaire possesses, who wields the coercive power of the state and on whose discretion it depends whether and how I am to be allowed to live or to work." The bureaucratic wing of the new class has other special rights and privileges as well. For starters, its members are virtually unfireable. Death, rather than poor performance, misconduct, or layoffs, is the primary threat to job security at the Environmental Protection Agency, the Small Business Administration, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, the Office of Management and Budget, and a dozen other federal operations, a study by USA Today found. In 2010, the 168,000 federal workers in Washington, D.C., who are quite well compensated, had a job security rate of 99.74%. A HUD spokesman told USA Today that his department's low dismissal rate, providing a 99.85% job security rate for employees, shows a skilled and committed workforce. Not to overly strain the analogy, but if the bureaucrats are a priesthood, the public sector unions are its Jesuits. Unions, by their nature, are first and foremost concerned with their own members' interests. Private sector unions often do not put the consumers, never mind the employers, well-being above their own, and public sector workers do not put the citizenry's interests first either. Many individual members of teachers' unions no doubt care about the plight of students, but there is remarkably little empirical evidence that they institutionally put the interests of children ahead of their own. I've tried to avoid making explicitly partisan arguments, but attention must be made to the insidious and incestuous relationship between the Democratic Party and government unions. It is no accident that the National Treasury Employees Union, which represents the IRS, gave about 96% of its political donations during the 2016 election cycle to Democratic candidates. In 2016, the American Federation of Government Employees contributed about 93% of its political donations to Democratic candidates. It is fine to argue that the wealthy support the Republican Party out of economic self-interest, even if the evidence for this is disputable. But is it really so ridiculous to imagine that a class of workers might be seduced by the same impulses? The new class is economically, ideologically, and psychologically invested in the primacy of government. It should not surprise us that its members would seek to protect that investment by supporting the party of government, particularly the shadow government. Milovan Gilas, writing about the new class in communist countries, observed that this new class, the bureaucracy, did not come to power to complete a new economic order, but to establish its own and, in so doing, to establish its power over society. There are obvious differences between the new class of, say, the Soviet Union and the United States of America. But beneath the ideological and cultural distinctions, no matter how important, lies the unchanging fact of human nature. There is no limiting principle inherent to the idea that a caste of experts should be empowered to do whatever they think is right. The one idea even the most pragmatic bureaucrat will never contemplate is the suggestion that maybe we would be better off if he did not have a job anymore. One more point must be made, or remade but emphasized. In its best and most sincere form, the argument for a disinterested permanent bureaucracy walled off from elected politicians hinges upon the claim that this is the only way to advance the public interest against private interests. The problem with this claim is that it is patently false on its face. The branch of economics called public choice has demonstrated at length that in a system in which you have concentrated benefits and dispersed costs, a small number of agents with a lot to gain often, maybe even routinely, overpower the interests of the majority. Democracies naturally tend to give special benefits to certain groups or constituencies. The groups care a great deal about these benefits, but the general public does not. The beneficiaries come to expect and depend on these so-called rents and will fight with a passion to keep them. But there are few constituencies nearly as committed to getting rid of them. Over time, the special interests proliferate. The more they proliferate, the more the government sector grows, but also becomes a kind of virtual tragedy of the commons, as it becomes clear to all others that they too must press for their own special benefits. This is one reason for the incredible explosion of lobbying over the last 40 years. Eventually, more and more of the government becomes dedicated to servicing special interests, and the ability of the government to deal with new or simply more pressing challenges narrows. Rather, the government gets better and more efficient at servicing the needs of clients while becoming clumsy and unresponsive to more important public problems. In short, the government becomes sclerotic, hence the sclerosis and demosclerosis, a term coined by Jonathan Rauch in his 1994 book by the same name. Rauch defined demosclerosis as government's progressive loss of the ability to adapt. This process has been identified in virtually every advanced democratic country. The favor seekers, Rauch writes, are acting not out of greed or depravity, but out of the impulse to survive in the world as they find it. Good intentions, or at least honest intentions, breed collective ruin. Responding to complaints from lawmakers that so many businessmen and politicians were lobbying the Federal Communications Commission, the economist Ronald Coase replied that this should be happening is hardly surprising. He added that when rights worth millions of dollars are awarded to one businessman and denied to others, it is no wonder if some applicants become over-anxious and attempt to use whatever influence they have, political and otherwise, particularly as they can never be sure what pressure the other applicants may be exerting. One of the most famous examples is the Mohair subsidy. Virtually nobody benefits from the Mohair subsidy, implemented over 60 years ago, save producers of mohair. And yet it survives. It survives because the mohair lobby cares only about one thing, while the public cares about many much more important things. In fairness, the mohair subsidy, like the sugar subsidy and countless others, is primarily an indictment of Congress. But at least Congress is elected. The bureaucracy, which on its own terms is supposed to be walled off from special interests, is even more susceptible to special pleading, precisely because it is shielded from voters. A congressman who relentlessly provides earmarks or other favors for donors can be booted from office. But what of a bureaucrat? Yes, a government official who takes a bribe can be fired. And it even occasionally happens. But that kind of corruption is trivial. The real corruption, the corruption that more directly stems from human nature, is when the regulator becomes so parasitically connected to that which he regulates that he cannot break the connection. Most public choice economists tend to call this regulatory capture. There are many different kinds of regulatory capture, and it goes by many different names in the fields of economics and political science. The late great political scientist James Q. Wilson, who preferred the term client politics, argued in Bureaucracy, What Government Agencies Do and Why They Do It, that it occurs when most or all of the benefits of a program go to some single, reasonably small interest and industry, profession, or locality, but most or all of the costs will be borne by a large number of people, for example, all taxpayers. I have no objection to the term regulatory capture, but I think the term guild economics is the most apt to highlight the true nature of what most concerns me. In medieval economies, as we've seen, political and economic interests were invested in existing economic arrangements. Innovation was an enemy because it unsettled not just the economic order, but the social order as well. The key instrument undergirding guild economics was the granting of special rights or privileges by the crown. Now, as then, these grants often go by the term license. Rulers in Europe, Asia, and the Middle East granted licenses to virtually every kind of manufacture, trade, and craft. It was one of the kings and queens and emperors and czars and sultans' many prerogative powers. Sometimes these licenses were as much cultural or even theological. Milton Friedman writes, "Licensure is a special case of a much more general and exceedingly widespread phenomenon, namely, edicts that individuals may not engage in particular economic activities except under conditions laid down by a constituted authority of the state." He continues, "Medieval guilds were a particular example of an explicit system for specifying which individuals should be permitted to follow particular pursuits." The Indian caste system is another example. To a considerable extent in the caste system, to a lesser extent in the guilds, the restrictions were enforced by general social customs rather than explicitly by government. In Europe, guilds formed around these rights and privileges, and entrepreneurs could face a wide range of punishments, including death, for violating them. Guilds and the ruling nobility both benefited from this system and worked together for its perpetuation. The growth of modern commercial baking and ale brewing in England led to the ale and bread assizes, statutes and roving courts assigned with enforcing them. From a progressive perspective, this was the beginning of the noble government tradition of assuring minimal safety and quality standards for food. But, as medieval historian James Davis shows, they were in reality a de facto licensing system. In effect, the lords or corporations were exacting a percentage of the trader's profits. Many saw this as a customary right, or what the mafia would call a piece of the action. The 13th century seneschalcy, office of the steward, advised that without warrant from the lord, no baking or brewing ought to take place on any manor. And in many places, particularly in the 13th and 14th centuries, lords explicitly gave actual licenses or imposed tolls for brewing. During the 14th and 15th centuries in Germany, even the urban poets of each little town were organized into guilds, notes Deirdre McCloskey. Even in Scotland, the Corporation of Glasgow, to avoid competition, denied a young James Watt license to set up a workshop. He was driven, happily, to apply to the university and then invented the separate condenser. Without permission from the guild, you could not innovate in producing cloth and were unlikely to evade the monopoly unless you could set up your factory, as in England, out in the countryside. McCloskey continues, "If you wish nowadays to set up a new pharmacy in Holland, you must apply to a town committee composed of other local pharmacists. Guess how many pharmacies there are in Holland?" This is the purest form of regulatory capture in guild economics, when the members of the industry themselves become the regulator. Such systems are ubiquitous and continuous, from at least the 13th century straight through to today. The acclaimed legal scholar Walter Gellhorn pioneered the study of occupational licensing in his book, Individual Freedom and Governmental Restraints. 75% of the occupational licensing boards at work in this country today are composed exclusively of licensed practitioners in the respective occupations, Gellhorn wrote in 1956. The problem has only gotten worse in recent years. In the 1950s, less than 5% of workers were required to obtain official permission from the government, i.e., a license to work. Today, 29% of U.S. workers need a license to earn a paycheck in their desired fields. A government study conducted by the Obama administration found that the surge in occupational licensing has been one of the more important economic trends of the past few decades. Today, one quarter of U.S. workers must have a state license to do their jobs, a fivefold increase since the 1950s. Including federal and local licenses, an even higher share of the workforce now has a license. To the administration's credit, it concluded that by making it harder to enter a profession, licensing can reduce employment opportunities, lower wages for excluded workers, and increase costs for consumers. The perniciousness of occupational licensing is most acute in its capacity to keep millions of low-skilled, entry-level, and uneducated workers from entering the workforce. The Institute for Justice has been a heroic champion documenting and fighting this trend. Perhaps the most notorious example it has cast a light on is professional hair braiding for black women. Natural hair braiding requires no special chemicals, no scissors, heat, or any dangerous equipment of any kind. It is a skill that is traditionally passed from mothers to daughters. And yet, 13 states still require a cosmetology license to sell the service. Such a license takes up to 2,100 hours in coursework and up to $20,000 in fees. 14 other states require a somewhat less onerous license for hair braiding. But this is just the tip of the iceberg. The Institute for Justice has a massive database of low-income professions that have set up guild protections barring carpenters, barbers, manicurists, makeup artists, milk samplers, fishers, fire alarm installers, and many other professions that historically reward a good work ethic and provide a path to a middle-class life for low-income workers. One needn't be a libertarian purist on the subject to nonetheless be outraged by the general trend. Perhaps it is necessary for exterminators to have some state-sanctioned training, but do they really need 4 years of education or 2 years working under another licensee as required by the state of Tennessee? Contrary to the misperceptions of some, most businesses do not see it as in their interest to do bad work. An employer wants skilled employees and in most cases can be trusted to train them as required. Employers understand the importance of word-of-mouth referrals and professional reputation better than most. McDonald's trains inexperienced workers to handle food for millions of customers. Do we really believe that the safety of Big Macs would be dramatically improved by requiring teenagers to take a state-mandated course? Moreover, thanks to the advent of internet rating systems, Yelp, Google, etc., not to mention the ubiquity of informal reviews on social media, Facebook, Twitter, etc., it is easier than ever for consumers to hold businesses accountable. An industry that depends on the good graces, i.e. the concentrated benefits, of a regulatory agency will inevitably and unavoidably commit itself to parasitically attaching itself to that agency. The guilds supported the king because the king supported them. It can also work the other way around. George Gilder observed, "A regulatory apparatus is a parasite that can grow larger than its host industry and become in turn a host itself, with the industry reduced to parasitism, dependent on the subsidies and protections of the very government body that initially sapped its strength." Consider the taxi industry. In New York City, the taxicab business was hugely profitable because yellow cabs were granted a monopoly by the government. Yellow cabs even got a very medieval-looking official seal called a medallion. For decades, taxi medallions outperformed the Dow Industrial Average and even gold. The reason they were so valuable? The city of New York froze the number of medallions and essentially held it constant as the population of New York and the number of visiting tourists exploded. Government-imposed scarcity was an enormous boon to the taxicab guild. In 2013, the total value of taxi medallions and related assets in New York City was $16.6 billion. In Chicago, it was $2.5 billion. Such cartels, basically another word for guilds, maintained their monopolies in city after city. Then, something changed. In a word, Uber. The company, along with other ride-sharing innovators,